Deputy Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development, the Director General of COPTA, and the officials that are here. I'm making some misrepresentations and talking about the DG of COPTA instead of justice, because it's too early in the new year. Deputy Minister, I think we are in your hands. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I think maybe the officials should just introduce themselves, if that could be possible. Starting with the DG.
Thank you, Dion. good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. My name is Vusi Matansela, Director General of the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development.
Okay, good morning. I'm Kale Pele, DDG Legislative Development.
Good morning, I'm Lawrence Bassett from Legislative Development.
Good morning, my name is Dingaan Mangena from Department of Justice Legislative Development.
Morning, my name is Teresa Ross, also from the Department of Justice. Thank you.
Chairperson, good morning. I'm Aisha Jaram from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
Good morning, I'm Suraya Williams and I'm from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor.
I think the officials are entitled to know others who are sitting behind them, unless it's for sabotage purpose.
Morning, Chairperson and honourable members. I'm Anthea Gordon, Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Morning, Chairperson. The name is Judith Chabalala. I'm the Parliamentary Liaising Officer in the Ministry.
Welcome. Honourable members, let's allow the department to make the presentation.
Chair, thanks. Maybe just some procedural points first. Firstly, with regard to one of the people who'd introduced themselves, she was not being that accurate. Ms. Johar is, in fact, acting Chief State Law Advisor. Mr. Daniels has left and gone to another section of government. So Ms. Johar is acting in his place for the moment.
Deputy Minister, you must allow people to be modest. You know, she's modest.
Yeah, it's a bad start when the acting Chief State Law Advisor gives factually incorrect information to the Parliamentary Committee. But Chair, there are two items on the agenda. The one is the traditional courts bill. The other is the repeal of the Rome Statute. The Minister had wanted to attend, but then had to, at short notice, attend another urgent meeting in Pretoria. So he will be starting, or in Gauteng. So he will be starting there and then should be joining us by the afternoon to deal with the repeal of the Rome Statute. Then, really starting the process with the traditional courts bill, it was introduced yesterday, so it's now Bill 1 of 2017. The bill that was on the departmental website that we gave out at a meeting last Monday, there are slight more technical amendments to that affected by the state law advisors. So just to indicate, but this version that I think you've been given copies here, I think it's on the middle of the table, is now the official version of the traditional courts bill to be worked on. The officials from the legislation section will just take you through the main parts of the bill, but I just wanted to say a few words about the process as to where did this bill come from. And obviously, as everybody knows, the earlier version of the bill that was with Parliament, which was, it's had a long passage. The Law Reform Commission investigated the issue of traditional courts, I think, in the early part of this century, I mean, year 2000. They had extensive consultations, came up with a draft bill. A bill was finally introduced in 2008, but the Justice Portfolio Committee didn't have enough time to process it before the elections. It was then in the same form reintroduced in the National Council of Provinces, but underwent a lot of criticism, and then effectively lapsed in the NCOP. What we have then tried to do is to bring together, I mean, it's a controversial issue. I think the clear issue to be understood with the bill is that we are not wanting to create traditional courts. Traditional courts are there, they exist in many communities. What the intention of the bill is to regulate them and bring them in line with the Constitution and accept the fact that people do things differently according to different traditional communities. So what people from the Abatembu do may be different to people in KZN, and those need to be recognized. What we did from the ministry's side was to invite, we tried as much engagement as possible. So we started the process with having an engagement with traditional leaders from the national and provincial houses, as well as Controlesa, to discuss the bill. We then had a similar engagement with representatives of civil society organizations, and we ended up, this is at the end of 2015, with having a joint engagement with civil society organizations and traditional leaders. Arising out of that process, with the agreement of all the participants, we then established what we called a reference group of representatives of traditional leaders from the National House and some of the provincial houses and from Controlesa. And then we invited civil society organizations to send us people to participate in the process. The civil society people were not representatives of their organizations because that implies that they would have been getting mandates and having to take things back. So we established a reference group to assist us with the drafting process and advise us on the way forward and to try and reach as much consensus as possible. And that process took most of last year with a number of meetings. At some one stage, with the agreement of the reference group, we in fact broke it down into a smaller task team to try and speed up the work. But the result then is the bill largely that you see in front of you. We did try and be as inclusive as possible. I think one of the points which is a little bit disappointing, I mean, since the bill has come out, we've seen criticism in particular from Professor Aninka Klaasens from the Land Accountability, can't remember the rest of it, LARC. We did invite LARC to send somebody to participate, and they unfortunately didn't take us up on that offer. So I just think it's important that people did have opportunities. But I think let me leave it like that for now. What I'd like then is for the officials to go through the presentation. At the end of their presentation, I may want to add just as to certain formulations that the reference group had largely agreed upon that may be necessary, why a decision was taken to word something in a particular way or approach it in a particular way. So, Chairperson, let me then hand over to the DDG for legislation, Ms. Pillay, to direct her team or to give us the lead on the process. Thanks.
Mrs.
Thank you, Chair. The presentation will be led by Ms. Ross.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, the Traditional Courts Bill aims to create a legislative framework in order to regulate the role and functions of traditional leaders in the resolution of certain disputes in accordance with constitutional imperatives and values. The bill is intended to improve access to justice services by enhancing the effectiveness, efficiency, and integrity of traditional courts for purposes of resolving disputes, with a view to promoting social cohesion, coexistence, and peace and harmony in communities. The bill can be linked to the targets of the National Development Plan, that of realizing a developmental, capable and ethical state that treats citizens with dignity, broadening social cohesion, and supporting the role of women as leaders in all sectors of the society. The traditional courts in our communities do exist. However, it is imperative that they be transformed in order to suit the new constitutional dispensation. Chapter 12 of the Constitution recognizes the institution, status, and role of traditional leadership according to customary law, subject to the Constitution. And Schedule 6 to the Constitution recognizes the existence of traditional courts. This bill is new, and every effort has been made to address the concerns that were raised in respect of the two previous bills that were introduced into Parliament in 2008 and 2012, respectively, and most significantly in regards to the role of women and other vulnerable groups. The bill further recognizes the different levels of dispute resolution that exist in the traditional justice system. Chair, I'll now move on to the key features of the bill, which are contained in the slides to the presentation. The guiding principles to the bill important because they set the scene for what is expected of traditional courts when they deal with disputes. And of high importance is constitutional values, for instance, the right to dignity, the achievement of equality, the promotion of non-racialism and non-sexism, freedom of sexual orientation and identity. The focus of this bill is on restorative justice and reconciliation through mediation. And the courts must bear in mind the existence of systemic unfair discrimination and inequalities or attitudes which are in conflict with the Constitution or which have the propensity of precluding meaningful and voluntary participation in court proceedings by any person or group of persons, particularly in respect of their gender identity, sexual orientation, age, disability, religion, language, marital status, and race brought about by colonialism, apartheid, and patriarchy. A further focus is in the voluntary nature of customary law and customary courts, which is accessible to those should they voluntarily subject themselves to the customary law and traditional courts. This, Chair, is a departure from the previous two bills that I mentioned, in that the bills did not provide for or did not highlight the voluntary nature of the customary of participation in the traditional justice system. Now, coming to the institution of proceedings in traditional courts, proceedings may not be instituted in the traditional court if the dispute is being dealt with at another level in the traditional justice system, or if the matter is pending before a court of law or is being investigated by the SAPS. A court may, furthermore, only hear a matter if the party against whom the proceedings are instituted agrees to the resolution of the dispute in that court, that's in the traditional court. This is important because it gives effect to the consent that the previous bill did not provide for the right to opt out of the traditional justice system. However, a person who elects not to have a dispute dealt with in the traditional court must give reasons for that decision to the clerk of the court. And if this happens, the court can continue with the proceedings in the absence of the person who has opted not to take part or not in the traditional justice system. And the purpose thereof will be to assist the remaining party. However, the court may not make an order against the absent party. Further, clause 4 read with Schedule 2 to the bill also sets out the types of disputes that a traditional court may deal with, thereby limiting the matters which this type of court can hear to less serious disputes which disturb harmonious relations within communities. Also in clause 4, a reference is made to disputes, meaning that there is no distinction between civil and criminal jurisdictions, which was one of the concerns that was raised in respect of the previous two bills. The traditional court must be constituted by of men and women pursuant to promoting the right to equality as contemplated in Section 9 of the Constitution. These courts are required to promote and protect the representation and participation of women, both as parties and as members of the court. The Minister of Justice is required, as well as the Commission for Gender Equality, to put measures in place to promote gender equality in these courts and to report on those measures annually to Parliament. Before the court can start with the proceedings, the traditional leader or a delegated person for purposes of convening the court must say a pledge that he or she will promote the values as enshrined in the Constitution. Traditional courts of law under customary law, with the specific purpose of promoting the equitable and fair resolution of disputes in a manner that is underpinned by the value system applicable to customary law and custom, and also functions in terms of the Constitution. These courts do not function as courts referred to in Chapter 8 of the Constitution. Their focus is on preventing conflict, maintaining peace and harmony, and resolving disputes in a manner that promotes restorative justice, social cohesion, and reconciliation. For the procedure in traditional courts, this principle, or rather the clause on the provisions on the procedure, takes the guiding principles in clause 3 in the bill,
by building in safeguards for the protection and assistance of vulnerable groups, with particular reference to women as litigants, as well as members of the court, the elderly, children, and the youth, as well as the indigent and persons with disabilities, and also to persons who are subject to the discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and sexual identity. The safeguards require, for instance, that all court proceedings must be open to all members of the community at a place which is accessible to all, to members of the community. Proceedings must be conducted in the presence of both parties, and both parties must be able to participate fully in the proceedings without any discrimination on the prohibited grounds listed in Section 9, Subsection 3 of the Constitution. Failure to comply with these procedural aspects can result on a matter being taken on review to the High Court. The provincial registers, for which provision is made in the bill, are required to assist unhappy or aggrieved litigants to take their matters on review. Parties are furthermore allowed to be assisted by any person of their choice in whom they have confidence. Legal representation is still not allowed in the bill, and there seems to be a general consensus that legal representation is not suited for the traditional justice system. In the case of the orders that the court may give, the orders are set out in the bill, and they differ drastically from the ones that were provided for in the previous bill, in this way addressing the concerns that were raised in respect of the previous two bills. The previous bills provided for the imposition of fines, and the deprivation of customary law benefits. And the bill does not provide for any of those sanctions which could lead to abuses. There's emphasis on restorative justice. For instance, the court may give orders of compensation and redress, which are aimed at restoring the relations between the parties and promoting social cohesion. Payment of compensation may not exceed the value of the damage that gave rise to the dispute, or the amount determined by the minister from time to time by notice in the Government Gazette, whichever is lesser, whether is the value of the damage or the amount determined by the minister. There is no provision for fines to be imposed, and community service ordered must be for the good of the community and not for the benefit of any member of the traditional court or of the traditional leader. How the orders of the traditional court are aimed to be enforced? A mechanism is required in order to ensure that orders of traditional courts are complied with, failing which litigants will resort to unlawful measures and bring traditional courts into disrepute. The mechanism proposed in the bill is as follows. If a party fails to comply with an order, the aggrieved party can approach the clerk of the court, who will try to mediate for the compliance with the order. If the intervention by the clerk of the court is unsuccessful, the clerk must then refer the matter to a justice of the peace appointed by the minister for that purpose in terms of the justice of the peace and commissioners of oath act of 1963. The justice of the peace will then deal with the matter in terms of the powers given to him or her as may be conferred under the act or that act. The bill makes provision for the appointment or designation of provincial traditional court registrars and also sets out their role and responsibilities. For instance, compiling and maintaining a prescribed register for all traditional courts in the province, referring cases of public interest to the High Court in order to contribute to jurisprudence or enhance the reform of customary law, transferring cases in respect of which traditional courts do not have jurisdiction, transferring such matters to the appropriate court, assisting parties and guiding and supervising the functioning of traditional courts. Chair, this provision emanates from a report of the Law Commission on the traditional justice system or the role of traditional leaders in the administration of justice. It was not in the previous two bills, and it is now provision is now made on in this bill for that. The bill also makes provision for review of shortcomings or more of procedural shortcomings to the High Court. For instance, if the court was not properly constituted or the parties were not allowed to be represented by a person of their choice, the High Court can confirm, alter, set aside or correct the order made by the traditional court, or set aside or correct the proceedings of the traditional court, make the order the traditional court ought to have made, or remit the case to the traditional court to deal with the matter ordered by the High Court. These reviews will contribute to the precedence and enhance the jurisprudence in matters of this nature. Chair, the previous bill, or rather the principle that I'm going to talk on, differs or is rather a departure from the provision that was contained in the previous bill, in that that bill made provision for appeals. But the bill now allows rather for escalation of matters from traditional courts to a customary institutional structure in accordance with customary law and custom. And this addresses the concern that was raised in respect of the previous bill, which allowed for appeals to magistrates' court. Appeals may not be lodged in respect of procedural irregularities. Now, coming to the general provisions of the bill also regulates the keeping of records of proceedings of traditional courts, the transfer of disputes from traditional courts to magistrates' courts and vice versa, the limitation of liability for members of traditional courts, a code of conduct for members and for a code of conduct for members of the traditional courts. Of particular importance is Clause 17, which requires the minister to make regulations on the training of traditional leaders and members of traditional courts and the involvement and training of paralegals and interns in the functioning of traditional courts. Thank you, Chair. That is the presentation.
Chair, as I said, if I can just highlight certain issues that really came from the reference group. The first is that there was agreement that the bill should look at traditional courts rather than having too much detail on customary law, that the purpose of the bill was the regulation of traditional courts, which obviously operate in terms of customary law, but that wouldn't form the major part of the bill. The issue of the institution of proceedings, there was a general consensus by the reference group, but there was quite a lot of debate over it. The basic principle is that if a person doesn't want to participate, they don't have to, but they can't just ignore the summons. They would have to inform the clerk of the court that they are not wanting to attend. There was a lot of debate around should they give reasons or not. Eventually there was agreement that it was probably better that they don't give reasons if those reasons related to some of the people in the community. The clerk is meant to ask whether there's any other court or any other way of resolving the dispute, but just to highlight that there was a lot of debate on that. The issue of the gender question actually wasn't, as far as I recall, there wasn't too much debate around it. The issue is basically how do you take, well, firstly, all traditional courts are not the same. Some communities will have a traditional court being comprised of a panel. Others would be the whole village or anyone in the village who wants to come. But the provision is made, as you've seen, for monitoring by steps to be taken by the minister and monitoring by the minister backed up by the Gender Commission. The nature of traditional courts, I think I do need to say that there was some dispute here, not with the reference group, but with the state law advisors. The reference group felt that they should be courts of law under Chapter 8, and there was a sort of strong argument from some of one of the traditional leaders particularly, that they were listed in the interim constitution as courts, and the certification judgment, we even went to look at that, hinted that was possible. The state law advisors have their concerns around the implications of being under Chapter 8, and I mean they can explain it. Eventually this formulation has gone in really in terms of getting the bill into Parliament, but I think it would be for the Portfolio Committee for Parliament to look at that question. We thought in the Department of getting legal opinions, but then thought it's better if Parliament deal with that issue, but just to tag that as an issue. Then, as far as the enforcement, we did look at the question. It's something traditional leaders have been raising for some time. We did look at the possibility of using sheriffs, but then rejected that on the basis that sheriffs are town or city based, and the distances between those sheriffs and traditional communities often are quite vast. We did work with Department of Traditional Affairs on the bill. One of the sort of issues I've seen raised is that there's no, what's it called, regulatory impact assessment, which seems to be a refrain that somebody's picked up on. There was, though, in terms of the cabinet process, that's no longer used. What is the current issue, which is a bit broader, socioeconomic impact assessment that was conducted. In terms of costing, we were informed by Department of Traditional Affairs that each court does have a clerk, so it's not going to be the creation of new positions. One position that is new is a provincial registrar, which is something that was in fact taken from the Law Reform Commission report, but not included in the earlier draft of the bill, but the Law Reform Commission proposed that. So that is a new position which would have to be funded, but otherwise there's very little that would require additional funding. Although I have heard the Gender Commission saying if they're given responsibilities for monitoring, they're going to want more money, so that's again something for Parliament to look at. The issue of review by the High Court, again, I think things differ in different parts of the country. I'm not really aware of, in the Eastern Cape or KwaZulu-Natal, of magistrates' courts hearing appeals from traditional courts. However, it does seem to be the norm in what was the former Transvaal. In what was Bophuthatswana, this provision in terms of a Bophuthatswana Act, which still exists, that the Premier must designate some people to work with the Chief Magistrate to hear appeals. In the former Venda, they would go straight from the traditional court to the Magistrates' Court. But the concern was that the traditional courts are about customary law. And that system of placing them under the magistrates was you know, really part of the control mechanisms from colonial and apartheid times. And so it's better that they're allowed to develop on their own, and the process then is that internal appeal mechanisms be looked at, which do occur in the case of in the Eastern Cape in KwaZulu-Natal. But it is an issue where they had been removed historically in the former Transvaal that would need to be looked at. Part of the job of the registrar is to assist with deciding on matters that should go on review. And then the other issue, just as far as education, I think Ms. Ross referred to the fact of the minister taking steps for the education of people involved in traditional courts. Just to remind the committee that the South African Judicial Education Act does provide, which is the body which deals with, it's chaired by the Chief Justice, it's the body which deals with the training of judicial officers, judges and magistrates. That act does provide for a representative of traditional leaders to sit on the SAJ Council, and it's Nkosi Mavundla, who was also active in the reference group. So, Chair, I just wanted to highlight that. Maybe the other point, I mean, the main criticism so far I've heard from civil society is that the bill, basically the authority for a traditional court derives from the traditional leader, and a traditional leader is a person who is recognized as such under law, in accordance with an act of parliament. Complaint I've heard is no, it should be recognized by the local community. Our concern with that, and yes, some members of civil society on the reference group were not in favor of this provision, but our concern with that was the issue of certainty. Now, some people don't like the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act. That act is being revised with the Khoisan and Traditional Leadership Bill, which is currently before Parliament. But we felt it's not for this bill and for justice to get into the question of who is a traditional leader and who isn't. That would be for other legislation to deal with. Maybe the last point, just on the geographic issue of traditional courts. There is provision made, I think it wasn't covered by the presentation, no, it wasn't covered, that if you have people from a particular traditional community somewhere in the country and they have a dispute and they are somewhere else, that they can request the traditional leader to have a court established for them where they are to deal with a dispute. So effectively, if you've got people from Msinga working in Joburg, there's a dispute between people from a particular clan that they can then request, instead of waiting for the dispute to be resolved back home, they can request the traditional leader to designate people or send people to deal with the dispute. So just to highlight that point, I think the last issue is that the schedule at the end of the bill, I think it's Schedule 1, there wasn't for some reason much discussion by the reference group on this. It's sort of been, I think, the other legislation and earlier drafts had matters that could not be dealt with by a traditional court. That was in an earlier draft. The state law advisor's advice was no, rather put it that matters that they are competent to deal with. But just to highlight, that wasn't necessarily in what's there, was not necessarily given, debated much. There's generally been a restriction on traditional courts dealing with matters which, where the result may be unfair because of, or perceived to be unfair because of patriarchy. So things like the custody of children and matters like that. The feeling was that it may be that a traditional court can discuss an issue, might have greater clarity because of their knowledge of the community as to who should look after a child, so that they should be given the chance to discuss it, but it wouldn't be an order. It would be something that then would be referred to the High Court or the Magistrates Court, but that court should be empowered to listen or hear the input of the traditional court on that particular matter. So just to highlight that in addition, Chair.
To Minister and Honourable Members, DG, you will know that we have waited for about 10 years for this bill to serve before us. One would have expected that we have reached a stage where we are beyond doubts. But also, I think that this bill actually should offer us an opportunity to reflect on the decolonization of the entire legal system, and in particular, indigenous African law. And for that purpose, one would have expected that we would start with the terminology itself. You know, there are customs and traditions. Now we are talking about the law of an indigenous people, which existed long before there was something called Great Britain or Rome. And the legal systems of the West, which came later, qualified to be law proper. And this most ancient African system is still just called a customary law, even by a democratic government. And that is a problem. I think that we need to look at the question of terminology. Are we dealing with the African law, or are we dealing with African customs? I think there's a difference, or should be a difference, between the two. But also, this English is a problem. If we talk about a senior traditional leaders, in all communities, they don't use the word senior, they don't use the word traditional leaders. What do they call these people themselves? Are we not able to use the language of the people? For instance, where I come from the Balobedu Nation, what you call a king would be a Mambo, and the Basotho would say Morena. The Vendors would say Tovela. The Nguni people would say Ndavezita. And those people are at a higher level than the king. And that's why the traditional leaders talk about Inkosi. Now, we have taken Inkosi we made Inkosi the king, whereas Inkosi is actually the senior traditional leader. Under the Inkosi, you have Magota, you have Maduna. So we need to clarify the terms so that we know what we are talking about. But also, we talk about appeals, and we say we want social cohesion. How do you have social cohesion when you fragment? Because the first thing is you must understand the structure of African society if you want to regulate the affairs. You have the what you call the king, which would be king of kings, Morena. You have the king, you have Magota. And when you deal with the legal system, it reflects the structure of society. So there's a court of Magota, of the headman, and the appeal must go to the Inkosi, and from the Inkosi, the appeal must go to Morena within. Now, if you go and introduce reviews by magistrates, by high courts, you are actually distorting the structure of society. You are actually working against the social cohesion that the constitution is calling about. But also the other question is, if our universities don't teach, make African law compulsory, they don't make indigenous laws compulsory, who are these judges and magistrates who qualify to review decisions by the traditional courts when they know nothing about the traditional laws, they don't understand the language of the people? Can we talk about justice in such a situation? So I'm saying the administrators of the traditional laws are not themselves qualified to review and hear appeals from the traditional courts. So this matter is more complicated than we want to make it. And why should people be made, be forced to do Afrikaans and Latin in order to become lawyers when they're going to practice amongst about 14 million people who don't speak Afrikaans and speak Latin, but we don't make it compulsory for people to go and study the languages of the people whose law they are going to apply. So there's just something that is wrong. For instance, the courts use the reports from social workers, psychiatrists, who don't understand the indigenous languages. You go to court, a man says, I want to divorce because the wife does not give me blankets. The magistrate says, no, go and buy other blankets. He doesn't know the idiom, because African jurisprudence is embodied in the languages of the people. Now, it means that you can't have social workers in the courts, psychologists, psychiatrists, lawyers, who don't understand the language of the people, unless we are talking about something and not justice. Also, African society, the traditional healers, leaders properly so-called, are also spiritual leaders, and their spirituality informs the values that are upheld in communities. So I am wondering whether our approach from the beginning has been correct. Another issue is boundaries. The cultural boundaries are not the same as the municipal boundaries. So that issue must be addressed. There's a question of procedure. I hear people even talk about legal representation or representation by another person. The system of indigenous law is not adversarial. It's not you and I in contest. It is inquisitorial. The accused is represented by the whole community that is there. And the issue is not about a traditional leader being presiding or not. He's guiding the proceedings, but the whole situation is participatory. So the procedure is different from procedures in the West. So things like legal representation should not even arise. And why do we overemphasize the participation of women? We do so because we have failed ourselves to implement the traditional framework act. Because if that act was implemented, women are given a quota in the traditional councils and they would automatically be fully represented in the traditional courts. Now we are trying to seek a solution to something that has been solved because we failed to implement the laws that we have made. And conflict of law, opting out. If people are going to be allowed to opt out, I must also be allowed to opt out of Roman Dutch law and common law. Because if I use my Kilobedu law, I would say I'm going to leave my assets to my son because this assets is to build the Motsega family. Because if I leave them to my daughter, she gets married to Honorable Mpumulwana, who will take my assets to KZN. That will distort my family. There will be no social cohesion. So opting out suggests that somebody is ranking African law below the other legal systems. And I think we need to discuss that matter. But also, we talk about communities. If we talk about communities, there are African communities. Why can't we talk about African community courts, African community law, African community justice? Why should we still come with some other dubious structures? Training. I know Sajay is conducting, some judges are conducting training for traditional leaders. How do judges who don't know the languages of the people, who don't know the law of the people, go and train the people on their law? And then the debate, Deputy Minister, about whether these are courts of law, the state law advisor says no, it's something else. State law advisors deal with technical matters. The substance cannot be dictated by them. I think it's a political matter that must be dealt with by politicians. The definition of traditional leaders. A traditional leader is there because that person is royal or blue blood, despite the fact that, of course, apartheid has distorted some of the things that Honorable Mpumulwana will talk about, but that is another matter that we can address. But lastly, I also don't know why we should take 10 years, 15 years to solve this matter. When our neighbors in Botswana have developed a system long ago, why have we not gone there? The Swazis have a stable system, the Basutus, the Ghanaians. Why should the amount of money that we spent for the past 15 years trying to solve something that actually is not a problem is a lot? I hope that this time we are going to act swiftly and be decisive, because the people who use this system know what they want. Our problem, we have brought lots of intellectuals in the matter who wants to test their theories in this area, and also who wants to import foreign concepts into an indigenous system that is stable, that is clear, that is understood. So we must just thank the officials for ultimately giving us a product that we can work with, and we are going to prioritize this matter. And I can assure you, we won't allow this matter to go beyond this year. By mid this year, we must finalize this bill, because we can't have a situation where our people think we don't take them seriously. We pass all kinds of laws, but what affects the people takes 15 years to be completed. We can't have that situation. Thank you very much. Honorable members, there is the product you have been waiting for. Honorable Maila, let me take all the hands. Honorable Maila, Honorable Swart, Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Horn, Honorable Mpumulwan, Honorable Bongo, Honorable Mutapo, Honorable Majake, in that order. Let's start with Honorable Maila.
Thanks very much. And thanks to the department for the presentation. Chairman, I have a gut feeling that we want to establish the most insignificant of the courts. That's the feeling I have. But maybe let's start with the issue of defining what traditional communities are. You know, in the rural area where I come from, surrounding the rural villages are the commercial farms, which in the main are owned by white farmers. And if there is to be social cohesion, it means the relationship between the white farmers and the communities should be in such a way that there is peace. However, there are always disputes between the white farmers and especially the seasonal workers who are not based in farms. They move from their areas of residence to go and sell their labor in the farms. Now, if the white farmers are not treated as part of the traditional community, then they will always opt out. And therefore, the traditional courts will never have a time where they resolve disputes between white farmers and the traditional communities. And reiterating what you said, Chairperson, if a white farmer can opt out of a traditional court, then the traditional communities also should be able to opt out from the other courts. I think we are in Africa here. But what is supposed to be the African indigenous law is taking the back seat, whereas the Roman Dutch law and the English law is given priority to prevail over Africans, which can't be correct. It says here that the courts must be accessible to those should they voluntarily subject themselves to the country. If it has to be voluntary, then it's a problem. Because I don't know. There is also the issue of the absent party, that the court can proceed while the other party is absent. But The court then cannot make an order against an absent person. So this is an exercise in futility. Well, why even go the route? Because it won't bear any fruits at the end of the day. The traditional leader must say a pledge. Is that what is happening in other courts? Do the magistrates say a pledge before the proceedings? If that happens, then it's fine. But I thought the issue that there will be a code of conduct for the presiding officers in the courts would actually be enough. The other issue is that the courts may not impose any fines. Then how do we make them to be effective if they can't issue any fines? No, Chairperson, thanks for now. I think that will be my input.
One research says less than 40% of South Africans have seen or even read the Constitution. When you say to a traditional leader, make a pledge, so you are saying they must lie, because they never saw that Constitution. They never read it. Then they must, under oath, say, we pledge to this Constitution. So where is constitutional education for our people? We must educate them first and not make them follow things they don't know.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the briefing. I think this matter has come a long way with the earlier drafts of the bill, and we had a brief explanation about the process of the task team and the discussions, and maybe you could unpack a little bit more, Deputy Minister, the process of engaging with the various traditional leaders and members of society, because it seems like the impression is created by previous speakers that very few people were consulted in the process of the draft of this bill. Obviously, Parliament will be having hearings, and maybe, Chair, we need to have visits to provinces as well to go and find out the concerns from the people on the ground and the degree of consultations that have taken place. Deputy Minister, you remember we visited traditional courts many years ago, so I've had limited knowledge of it, but I think some of the points that are made are very valid. I'm not so sure I agree with the focus on white farmers, but we can look at that a different time. The issue that I wanted to ask is whether there's been a socio-economic impact study done, and will that be forthcoming? I understand that most draft legislation requires a socio-economic impact study to be done, and clearly I think this bill has come a long way in addressing a lot of the concerns that were addressed in the earlier bills. Yes, there are some obvious issues now that might be of concern. The issue of the opt-in out clause, I just wanted to ask whether during consultations, would that not create pressures on that person that chooses to opt out in a traditional environment, the social pressures on that person? Has that been considered sufficiently? Deputy Minister, you touched on the issue whether these are traditional courts of law under customary law, clearly subject to the Constitution, or whether they are courts contemplated in Chapter 8 of the Constitution. It seems that you've left that more or less open to Parliament to decide on that, but you touched on that, and maybe you'd like to just unpack that a little more. I really like to focus on restorative justice, which is
the approach of indigenous courts in our country, Chair. We've alluded to that in the past. The issue about the appeals and reviews would then introduce the cooperation between indigenous law systems and Roman Dutch systems, and I appreciate what the chairperson has said in that regard. The aspect that is a concern to me is where, and what the chairperson pointed out, the different levels of appeals within the traditional system. Can one not look at that as well? And is that what is referred to in Clause 12, where there is reference to other customary institutions or structures? Could one not look at that to introduce a level of internal appeals within the traditional court structures? Because my concern is the cost implication. Understanding your point, Deputy Minister, on the removal of magistrates' courts because of the past, but the cost of reviews to the High Court is quite exorbitant. Is that something as well that you have considered? So just, I think you've made substantial progress with the bill and with bringing the different views together, and it's then beholden upon us as Parliament, Chairperson, to take the process forward. But I think a lot of good work has been done, and from our side, at first glance, I think the department and everyone involved needs to be commended in bringing this very necessary and complex legislation to the fore. It has taken a long time, I appreciate that, but it's not the first bite. We have had the other drafts that were rejected at different levels. So thank you for that, Chairperson.
Let me thank the two educators who have brought the learners here to observe what we are doing. This is the sitting of the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services. We are debating the bill on traditional courts. Welcome, and thank you for exposing the children to these processes early on, because this is their parliament. Thank you. Honorable Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the briefing. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that in this particular matter, public hearings are going to be really important to get the views of as wide a field as possible. Having listened to your setting out earlier, this is clearly a very complex issue and it's going to require a very careful approach. And I would suggest that if it's at all possible, we look at comparative systems as you suggested in Swaziland or Botswana or Lesotho and see how they function. I think it would be important for committee members to understand that. And I think we need to have a full understanding of that before we can properly begin to grapple with the box. As you said, it's been a long time in coming, and we really can't afford to mess it up again. We need to finalise the matter. I'm a little concerned, and perhaps the Deputy Minister can assist me on a perceived contradiction of mine in Clause 4 on page 5. It says that the court can continue with proceedings in the absence of a person who opts out. And then in Clause 7 under procedure, on page 8, says that proceedings must be conducted in the presence of both parties. I'm not too sure how that would function. I also don't fully understand the cost implications of the bill and who would be responsible for costs if they were incurred, for instance, by the justices of the peace. So with regards to particularly Clause 9 and the enforcement, if costs are incurred, it would be of some concern to me, but who would be liable for those costs? Those are just a few issues that I have. On the whole, this appears to be an improvement on the previous drafts. the previous bills, but I think that there's a huge amount of work that we still need to do on this particular matter. Thank you.
Where I come from in Bulawayo, you don't need justices of the peace. You have community volunteers called Maharula. So they're acting out as community service. Now, if you are going to appoint justices of the peace, you are right. Where are we going to get the money to pay all these people that must serve this more than 2,000 structures? So that's an issue that we must revisit. There are volunteers inside communities who serve the community. Why shouldn't they do the work? Honorable Hon.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me add my voice to say to the department, and thank you for the presentation. Chairperson, indeed, your introductory comments, I think, without mentioning it by name, clearly illustrated, I think, the conundrum Parliament is faced with in respect of the traditional courts bill, in the sense that I think we must remind ourselves that we a constitutional democracy, and even though maybe for political reasons you and other members are fond of talking about Roman Dutch law and so on, the fact of the matter is, along with other transformations we as a country chose to enforce in 1994 in South Africa, we also chose to transform our legal system from the Roman Dutch law into a new legal system based on our constitution. So I think it's not quite correct to harp on the issue of Roman Dutch law. As a matter of fact, I think we've come a long way in the more than 20 years to transform our legal system along the lines of the Constitution and the values underpinning the Constitution, which I think we all agreed on. So that brings one to the issue of now harmonizing these traditional courts, and I think I just want to add my voice to the Honorable Swart to say that I think one of the things that must be unpacked and decided specifically is what specifically will be the nature of these courts, whether they're ordinary courts of law or not. But the fact is, you cannot, on the one hand, in a bill, say that the values of our Constitution must be incorporated into the system, and then, on the other hand, close your eyes or turn your back on the Constitution itself. So that, to my mind, is something we will have to grapple with. And let me explain why I say this. Very specific issues like legal representation, and ultimately, as intended by our Constitution, the right and the duty of our constitutional court to be the final arbiter of whether any public power has been exercised in compliance with our constitution rests with the constitutional court. So the question now arises, if there's no appeals, how do we deal with this issue? You specifically and other members often point out that customary law, or if it's now African indigenous law, it doesn't matter, is as it is, and that's wonderful to hear, evolving. So it's not easy to, in terms of the content, say this is what the law says. But while it is evolving, I think one must also, and that's the one thing, even though this bill deal with the courts, which I think we must also look into, to say that ultimately, in the evolvement of the contents of customary law, isn't there also a duty, and how will we enforce it without appeal procedures to have the content of African indigenous law evolve in line with the Constitution. And now the presentation talks about not appeals but escalating matters to customary institutions or structures. So I agree with other members. I would like to go and see how these institutions, if appeals are not going to be allowed, who are these people? Because it's a very vague term. And how do these institutions function? Yes, in terms of the justices of the peace, likewise, one would like all the community volunteers you referred to. I think at this stage it's problematic then that one has no certain idea as to what exactly are the powers of these people. Because once again, we are living in a constitutional democracy, and the enforcement of these decisions of these courts cannot be done in a way which is in contradiction to our constitutional constitution. So yes, Jay, I agree that if one has perused the previous versions of the bill and one looks at the history, I think we are in dire need to find a system that works on in a way that we can say it's compliant with our constitution, but which also serves the community. But I think I must add my voice to say that we will have to tread very carefully, and that we will have, as Parliament, maybe go and see for ourselves how these bills that are, these courts that are to be regulated, not established, how they are working in practice, for us to get a clear understanding of what we must do as Parliament. Thank you.
Just a correction. I didn't say that we don't need appeals. I think Honorable Horn even put it better, to say you must exhaust the appeal systems inside the system itself, because there are three tiers in the community structure. You exhaust that before you move to the High Court or the Concord, provided that the High Court and the Concord and the magistrates also have been forced to learn indigenous law and indigenous languages. Otherwise, how could they have the final say on something that they don't know themselves? Honorable Pumulan.
Honorable Chair, I think we are in trouble. You see, the problem started, and I don't know how you can solve it. You see, when the river is going to the sea, it comes in there on the terms of the sea. The sea determines how the water should flow into the sea. And then the sediment. Here you are trying, you find a colonial power came with its own law, imposes that law, procedures and the system into the people. And now people must accept that system. Now you are saying, let us revive the African way of doing things, the legal system, and the procedures therein. And you put in, and you have not, and the old colonial system is still there, intact. Even if you put something in the constitution, it's still intact. Procedures and everything. Now you are introducing this to people, most of us who have gone to school and learned the English law, the Roman Dutch law, whatever it is, we think in those terms. Now, African people have been regarded as inferior to the European and the system of government as inferior to the system of government of the West. Now, what is understood by justice? You have got what is called customary law. I don't know what that means. But it means something that defines that what is acceptable in the European system as good moral standards, according to their definition of morals. You are now introducing that. So you have got these two people that must come together as one people of South Africa, social cohesion. The question is, will a white person go to the traditional courts and accept the system that he doesn't understand in the same manner that an African goes to the system of the European, which he does not understand but was forced to accept? You need one to have people to write exactly what is meant by African law, so that they understand, everybody get to know what it means. What is procedures therein? And thereafter, you need to explain to the people that, in fact, this is the best system, before you can say they must be forced to go to it. It's going to be very difficult. Secondly, you cannot say that other people must opt out, because if you do so, it means everybody, as you correctly put it, I may opt out and can't go to the magistrate court, or only go to the African traditional court. The question I want to ask from the... Those are just remarks to show how difficult our situation is now in trying to make this bill. What is the jurisdiction of this court? I'm using the terminology of what we understand by jurisdiction, which means, is there a form of ceiling in terms of its civil matters? Is there geographical areas? Chairperson, my understanding of the African law is that it's based on the family. Family. I'm not going to be called by Mgwena into disputes arising if there is a Mgwena family and a Dolo family. There is a dispute between the two. The two families, the one family will decide that I'll bring the case to the Mgwena family that their child has done something wrong, has murdered my child, or he has assaulted my child. And then they meet together. There is that family court. They meet there and they decide to tell me, to tell my family, whether they accept liability or not. So what I'm trying to say is more complex than that. Now, when you say traditional courts, what do you mean? So these are the issues that we need to grapple with first. Secondly, so the question of jurisdiction of geographical areas also doesn't really fall into the system. But since we've got the European system of geographical, when we think about jurisdiction, we talk about people sitting in a particular area. Secondly, I want to find out in terms of what cases. Because when the Europeans came, they made a distinction between what they call criminal and civil. with the African law, these are all mingled into one. What are you going to do? Are you going to remove the criminal? Because there's something that talks about the police, when the police are investigating the matter. I don't understand what that means. Are you saying that if police decides not to investigate matter, then the traditional courts can handle the matter? Or what exactly do you mean by that? So it's not clear, and I think that it is very difficult. I don't blame people from the Justice Department because it's very difficult to grasp this particular. The other part, I still ask that question so that people can probably give me. The question of opt-out has been dealt with. I don't want to talk about it now again. And then I don't want to get into what you want of the decision of who is the traditional leader, which I think is also another issue, particularly when it comes to the question of so-called Khoi and Sa, which you still have to find out. Everybody who say, I am a traditional leader, I am a traditional leader, there are problems there. But I think that can be dealt with differently. But I want to say it is important that, one, we do find out what is happening in Botswana and other areas. But what I've discovered, as far as I know, those areas, is highly disputed. It's not really pure African law that is being applied. There's a lot, it's watered down, particularly in places like Swaziland. But at least there is something. Secondly, we still have people who can give us information, elderly people, as to exactly how things should have been done. And probably we can learn from that. And I think that research needs to be done as soon as possible. I agree with you that this is just a start. Let us have the bill as a start. But let's work towards making one South African law which is based on the African values, Ubuntu, and the African system of government, before you can talk about, and then eventually we have our own completely different system, which is an African system. Thank you very much.
Yes, we can't blame anybody. We can only blame this parliament, which must make laws. It doesn't make laws that respond to the challenges that are facing the majority of the people in this country. We know that we need to seek African solutions to African problems. We're not doing that. So we're saying this year we're going to do things differently.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I would like to start by commending the department for bringing this matter, because we as Parliament have been waiting for this matter for quite some time now. I think Honourable Deputy Minister, thank you for bringing the matter to Parliament, and also thank the presentation made by the department. I think it's quite a good presentation. I would like to start by saying, Chair, because we need to move with the speed of a mirage in terms of finalizing this matter. Of importance it may be to develop a parliamentary program which will include, among others, us having to visit. I agree with other members who say we must visit these traditional courts ourselves and gain further knowledge in terms of how they run. I think, Chair, in terms of the Constitution recognizes customary law as the law in the Republic, obviously subject to the Constitution. But one of my concerns, I think, is what we have already raised, or some members raised, that it would appear we're treating these courts, as subordinate courts to the courts that are already exist. I think Honorable Deputy Minister, we may have to zoom and come closer to that one, on the status of the of these courts, because as far as I'm concerned, they must also be treated the same way as those that are referred to in terms of chapter 8 of the Constitution. So one other issue that I think the technical people must deal with is the issue of the boundaries. I'm also worried that as we develop this, we need to define the boundaries very clearly in terms of how do we move forward. And I'm quite impressed that we want to recognize this cost as part of a restorative justice, hence creating a social cohesion amongst communities. So the other issues that, which I thought Chairperson already answered or defined by the Act of Parliament, the issue of the definition of who exists the traditional leader, what is a senior and so forth, because I think the Traditional Framework Act does give some solution in terms of who is the traditional leader, who is the senior traditional leader. I think there are also regulations to that effect. I think we may have to visit that and be able to factor in those things in this particular legislation, so that we don't move unclear in terms of what exactly we really want to do. But when we conceived, Chair, this issue of the traditional court themselves, it was against the backdrop that of what the Chief Justice also said to us, that the courts are full. The role is too full that it can accommodate all other matters. So of importance, which what these courts must do, is also to offload that backlog that is in court. So if we were to do that successfully, we may need to look at the issue of speediness, because matters must be addressed in a speedy way. So I see here they say if somebody does not comply, what will happen is that must come back to the clerk of the court to start mediating. If the mediation does not succeed, then other processes. And that to me creates a serious lengthy process, which may take also months and months trying to enforce. I agree with Honorable Mpumlwana around the jurisdiction. I think we've got to be clear in terms of the jurisdiction. It is in twofold. One is the issue of a ceiling in terms of as you restore, to what level the amounts. Then secondly, it will be those issues that automatically cannot go to, because we've got to define that. It's like now in the courts, they will tell you this magistrate court has jurisdiction over this, but this one goes straight to high court for certain reasons. So we've got to define in this legislation here, in terms of this jurisdiction, which are matters that may either automatically have to be dealt with through other courts, so that we don't drag this court to be dealing with issues that we really do not intend them to deal with. And one other matter is the issue of the recourse and the appeals. Like I've said, that going to the normal courts the other day is a very expensive process. So expensive as it is, these appeals, I think there may be cost involved. How do we speed this deal, or how do we make sure that the turnaround strategy in terms of attending to these issues are properly done? And the recourse, for people who have brought these matters before this court. As to the issue of opting out, Chair, I think we've got to be quite clear and provide some framework or regulations as to, because it cannot be like you get into the court today, then you say, I opt out. Then you're disrupting the whole process. So we've got to have some way of determining would a person who will finally opt out must have met the following requirements, and those requirements must be strictly followed so that these courts are also enjoying the same respect as the courts that are already existing in the legal system. I think for now, Chair, those are my critical points. But we are very happy that the bill is now before Parliament. We'll have to just move with a serious speed in terms of consulting our people, consulting traditional leaders, and consulting every other interested party so that we finalize this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by thanking the Department, Deputy Minister, and the official DG officials for the presentation. Chairperson, when one looks at page 15 of the bill, Schedule 2, matters which traditional courts are competent to deal with in terms of this Act, in terms of Section 4, Subsection 2A. I'm a bit concerned, Chairperson, on G, advice relating to customary law practices in respect of number one, Roman figure one, ukuthwala. My concern is that, is it wise to name such a specifically that customary law practice such as ukuthwala? Isn't it there are other customary practices which are taking place elsewhere? But if we specifically make mention of this one, I'm a bit concerned there, Deputy Minister. Maybe you may clarify that. Again, let me also echo the sentiments of my colleague in terms of appeals and reviews, in terms of clauses 11 and 12. The Chairperson made mention, I don't know whether it's the Chairperson or Honorable Breitenbach, the situation. We have our own indigenous system whereby resolution starts within the family. From family, then it will be clan. From clan, it will go to a village. Village, then to the khoro, the main one, which is being referred to now as traditional court. Then, if other party is not satisfied, it will be better if that is taken, the same situation which is obtaining in Botswana, where they also have an indigenous justice system. There is an appeal of that kind. Why are we not using the same mechanism? Let me give an example. I normally say that, like in Bulubedu, those Magoshi around Bulubedu, they will know when they want to appeal, they will go to Sitagoni. Sitagoni, that's where the Queen is residing, for an appeal or a review mechanism. Then, if we then follow this other system whereby a review is taken to the High Court, let us take into consideration the cost implication also. Issue of access to justice here, the purpose which I think the department is looking into will be defeated. So also that let's take into consideration and consider a sort of a mechanism which will follow the one of indigenous legal system. And again, I appreciate the notion of provincial registrar. That is really very much a progressive DM. And then issue of enforcement mechanism in terms of DOS 9 is a bit dicey also. I agree with the speaker before me who made mention of that. Because the issue of, let's say it's the Hoshi who was presiding, then we say the clerk should then mediate. Whereas we know traditionally the Hoshi is above this clerk. Then the clerk is going to discuss the decision taken by the Hore. It's not the Hoshi per se. Because the Hoshi only will be, in most cases, the presiding officer, will only pronounce the judgment as per deliberations by the community. So are we not sort of trying to create something which is really not indigenous in this regard? Especially also creation of that, what is this? Peace,
this is?
Justice of peace also. It's something very, very foreign. In our culture. So maybe also let's sort of look into it and come up with a mechanism which will assist us in this regard. And then interpretation. Elsewhere in this document, it is said that where any of the party doesn't understand the language spoken in that area, interpretation will be provided. Then who will be responsible for that? Mind you, elsewhere also in this document, it is said an act or offense that shall have taken place in that particular area. It might have been committed by a Shona from, especially for us from Limpopo, we are neighbors with Zimbabwe. Then will then the department be able to provide such interpretation services to the traditional court? And then issue of there was a concern DM initially during the initial bill 2008-2012 regarding taking of a pledge before a magistrate. Magoshi were very much concerned, are we not then subjecting Magoshi to the magistrate? Why not also create, we have a national house of traditional leaders. And then in terms of line of authority, although or our kings and queens, so to say, because national house is normally chaired by a Hoshi who will be an equal to the presiding Hoshi. Why don't we make use of our kings and queens to take, for our presiding officers, to take an oath in front of those, unlike introduction of judge president, magistrates, and so forth. An issue of composition, court, I like it, it's also very progressive. However, the problem now is not with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, it's with COGTA. Because the implementation of Traditional Leadership Governance Framework Act lies with COGTA. COGTA has been delaying in the implementation of this act. Provision of budget to the traditional councils, nothing is happening. That's why I say in this regard, I'm not trying to defend the department, but it's COGTA's baby to see to it that the composition of even the councils, they are not formally composed, isn't it? So in this regard, in other cause, like Bakgakgaba Mothapo, everybody is participating in that khoro, irrespective of Mosadi, Monna, Mokgekolo, Sekolo, goba bjang. So I think maybe because during the media briefing you were with Deputy Minister Babela, maybe sort of talk to him regarding the issue of implementation of Traditional Leadership Governance Framework Act as amended. Because it's delay a lot of things, especially in Limpopo. I don't know of other provinces. So and then those the reference group, you are making mention of civil society, traditional leaders, and so forth. Maybe if you can unpack, if let's hope there are not more than 40 civil society organizations, because we don't want to see a situation when we go for public hearings, people start saying, yeah, it is for the first time we're seeing this document, and so forth, and so forth. And Chairperson, I would appreciate if really we take our rural community into confidence ge re tlo bolela ka this document, because it tlo affecta bona kudu. And ke a tshepa ka se sebaka ge ba re theleditse ba bona gore ke nnete re tswela pele, mmušo wa rena o ikemišeditse go thuša le go thekga batho ba magae gore le bona tokologo ye e ba fihlelele, ba e bone, ba be ba e kwe gabotse. Ka gore molao o le a gopola molawana o, ke kgale re ntse re bolela re le African National Congress gore ke e mengwe ya melawana e tshwantseng gore e phakišetswe, ka gore ka se sebaka re ka se re na le mengwaga e 20 re buša. Ya ba re sa bolela ka bo Black Administration Act, o e leng gore o bo re paledišwa gore ge o mongwe wa mmala o seng wa rena goba wo a sa dulego bolobedu ba ga Mothapo a ka dira ntlo e itsego, o bo o tla palela ke go mo sekiša. Bjalo ke nako ya gore bjalo re se ka dula fatshe. And I also appeal gore le rena as a portfolio committee chairperson, we have a joint engagement le COGTA portfolio committee. Thank you very much.
For my recollection is that witnesses take an oath and say we will tell the truth, nothing else but the truth. But when traditional leaders are appointed, they should actually take an oath at the appointment. Not that every day when they preside, they must make an oath. Otherwise, even the Chief Justice must make an oath every day he presides, if we are serious about the equality of persons under the Constitution. But the question of participation, you are right, is really a non-issue. The reason women are not participating is because as government we have failed to implement the Transitional Governance Framework Act. So that's where the emphasis should go. There's no problem. Women are not rejected. We are not implementing the law. Honorable Majake.
Thank you, Chairperson, to welcome the presentation from the Department of Justice. Thank you, Minister. Thank you, DG. To say indeed, the Constitution recognizes customary law, so no matter what happens, we have to make this to work. And South Africans are actually looking forward to seeing a system of this nature that they will find it easy to utilize. issues like jurisdiction has been touched on, and I think it's something that needs to be carefully looked at jointly with traditional leaders. Otherwise, we're going to find that we can actually end up with a piece of legislation that may be difficult to implement. So some of the things needs to be preempted in order for us to avoid them as problems. And indeed, I support the sentiment that we shouldn't actually have some piece of legislation that depends on voluntarism, where people decide whether they can participate or not. Because if it's about law, law remains law and it must be binding. Otherwise, it's actually going to lead into an institution that is not effective. Because at the end of the day, that institution needs to be effective. And also, with the same kind of provisions we will have in this bill, we must also have an idea of how the court is going to actually manage to implement its own proceedings. Enforceability is important. We talk about the justice of peace. The issue of the sheriff wasn't really very clear as to whether there will be a sheriff, some form of sheriff. And as to how summons are going to be delivered, it's very important. Because appearance in this court is actually also going to be important. But why I'm mentioning all of these things, I think at the end of the day, Deputy Minister, whatever we come up with as a country, we should actually also take into consideration the finances around it. Because I'm talking about jurisdiction, I'm talking about structures. Because I know that our kind of traditional arrangements have got too many setups, whether we call them Mahoshi, whether we call them Dindonadi, but we need to know and actually have an idea as to how many courts roughly we are talking about in the country. And just thinking about it this way actually will tell us as to whether what we've got at hand is something that's going to actually finally work for our people, or it's not going to work, it's going to fail. We need to apply our minds to it. What is good about this course indeed is that it's going to actually help the court rolls to reduce the cases that are pending. It will reduce the load that we've got. We also deal with correctional services, and we have a lot of remand detainees. It will reduce that. But at the end of the day, the system that we will have should be such that it's going to actually work, and it must be something that will be easy to apply. On the issue of women, indeed we have failed in terms of implementation of the Traditional Framework Act. That still talks about a third, 30% representation of women in traditional councils. I think this same bill should actually manage to directly talk to issues of that nature in terms of the structures that will actually be established to be sure that there will be also equal representation of men and women within those structures. And then somewhere there is a clause that actually says that it's clause 4, 3A. Any person who has been summoned to appear before the traditional court for any reason elects not to have his or her dispute heard and determined by that traditional court, or to appear before that traditional court, must within 14 days of such longer period as may be necessary duly assisted or accompanied by any person of his or her own choice. what I'm thinking should actually happen is this thing of being duly assisted or accompanied, look at it carefully. Because already what you hear in the public space is that this is the kind of bill that's actually dictating that women must be accompanied by male relatives. I was actually trying to go through this to find an area that might actually be creating such suspicions. So please look at it and let's see to what extent this can actually be dealt with in a way that doesn't give an impression that such practices, if they existed before in our traditional communities, that they will actually continue to be practiced using this kind of a bill. Because what is important is to ensure that the Constitution of South Africa is actually used as a mirror in terms of development of this bill and also implementation. Anything that violates the Constitution of the country will therefore not be appropriate when it comes to development of this bill. Thank you, Chairperson.
Members, the Constitution is just a framework with the values, constitutional values that we must adhere to. We can't find all solutions in the Constitution. And the matter we are dealing with is not an academic matter. We need empirical evidence to be able to deal with it correctly. For instance, I'll give you an example of my own Queen Mujaji. She has more than 15 senior traditional leaders. Each one of them has a traditional court. And each of the 15 have ndunas. Each nduna has traditional courts. And then directly under her, she has 159 mandunas, which means in Bulawayo only, you'll have about 300 courts, traditional courts. Are you going to appoint justices of the peace for all those traditional courts? Are you going to provide funding for all those structures? Are you going to cater for appeals from all those structures? So I think that we're dealing with this matter academically. We need empirical evidence, and we should not simply have said we are consulting. We should find out from the people what is it that they are doing, how are they doing it, how can we rationalize these things. So I don't think that we should really blame anybody except ourselves, and also I don't think that we can say the department must answer anything, because they have done their best under the circumstances. But as Parliament, we have our responsibilities to do what needs to be done. So I don't think we can even be asking them to explain things. Oh, Deputy Minister.
Yeah, I did want to respond, and the officials can maybe add. I do take the point, though. But just there were, I think, some issues of process that are necessary to clarify. This is a complicated issue. It has been something that has been on the agenda for, I think, the last 16 years, first with the Law Reform Commission, then the 2008 bill, then the 2012 bill, which was really the same as the 2008 bill. The bill, the 2012 bill in the NCOP, failed. It ultimately lapsed, but there was a lot of division. I mean, the NCOP had numerous public hearings all over the country, and it was clear there were a lot of divisions on issues such as the role of women, on the issue of the voluntary or other nature of these of traditional courts. And what we then tried to do in restarting the process was particularly get the reference group to address those questions. So as far as broader participation, it has been then with representatives of traditional leaders and members of civil society that we've sat with. But the bill then is now with the committee, so it's now with Parliament. It is for the committee to decide how to process it and ultimately what changes to make. I think legally the only power that the executive, that the minister has, is to withdraw the bill. But it's the bill is now with yourselves. We have to assist. I mean, I'm told the bill has already been translated into isiXhosa, Sepedi, Setswana, and Siswati, with the other languages coming, although I'm told there's a slight problem of capacity for some reason with isiNdebele. I'm not quite sure why, but presumably the it's from the state law advisors. They don't have a isiNdebele person to translate into isiNdebele. But anyway, our intention then is that it would be Parliament that would be taking the bill out for public hearings. The only caution I would make is we need to try and get consensus on this bill, which wasn't there before, which was why it failed. As I'd said, the intention of the bill is not to create new structures, to accept the differences in different areas. So hence you don't find, a traditional court is a court established by a traditional leader. And it's left open as to what is a traditional leader. It's in terms of other legislation, because different procedures are followed. The idea was to allow those structures to continue as they did, but in line with the Constitution. The only thing is that particularly in the former Transvaal, where traditional courts, in certain areas at least, did appeal to the magistrates' court, that would go, precisely because of Honourable Bongo's point of these are not inferior to the magistrates' courts, which is where they were placed under colonialism and apartheid. Just more broadly on the question of appeals and legal representation, there's no legal representation in a small claims court. I don't think that has been tested. There's no legal representation at the CCMA, I think, or representation of attorneys. That has been subject to litigation, which was lost. And the problem is the moment you bring in lawyers, you overcomplicate matters. There's no appeals from small claims courts precisely for the same reason. If you know, they're meant to be quick, expeditious. If you start having appeals, you'll get stuck forever. You can't, Chair, as far as I'm aware, get away from the issue of review. The high courts have that jurisdiction of any action. It can be reviewed. But that starts at the high court, not at the magistrates' court. There is the issue of what is customary law, and I mean, I think when there have been cases at the High Court and ultimately at the Constitutional Court, the issue has not been, is this in accordance with customary law broadly, but is it in accordance with the customary law of that particular community? So the Shulubane case around female, I can never pronounce the word, primogeniture, but female succession, was not determined in terms of African customary law, but in terms of Tsonga customary law. Does Tsonga customary law allow a woman to succeed? The other case, I can't remember it, relating to the consultation of the first wife when the man wants to take an additional wife, was also a Tsonga matter and dealt with in terms of Tsonga customary law. The issue of the dispute over the succession, which is also a prima primogeniture, I don't know why I can't, issue of the succession of the king of the vendor is also being dealt with in terms of vendor customary law. How does vendor customary law work? So that's something that the high courts, the Concord does look at. But I think, you know, one would then hope that Parliament will look at research, remembering, though, that both all the countries mentioned are more homogeneous than South Africa is. The other one, just because it was generated a lot of discussion, the justices of the peace issue, it's the traditional leaders that had come to us saying, look, we need enforceability. It's one of the problems that we currently have with the courts is the inability to enforce matters. So that request or that section on enforcement came from them. We did, as I say, look at the question of sheriffs, but sheriffs were not really applicable because they would charge for the distance they travel from the magistrate's court to the traditional courthouse. The justice of the peace thing was then a suggestion, but just please remember, I mean, it may work, it may not work. I think the idea, Chair, was that they would be voluntary, and to Mr. Horn, they would operate in terms of the powers granted under the Justices of the Peace Act. So it doesn't need to specify them, one's not reinventing the wheel. But it came in response to traditional leaders. The pledge issue, I think the question in terms of the Constitution, judicial officers have to take a pledge, but it's a pledge taken once and it's a pledge to the Constitution. But I think it was more in line with that. I think let me leave it like that for now. I don't know if the officials will want to respond to specific points. But Chair, just as I said, to caution that this is there are a lot of strong views on the issue. The exercise really in coming up with this draft was to take the main contentious issues from the last bill and in engaging with traditional leaders and people from civil society, trying to find solutions and ways forward. And I would urge that in engaging with the bill, the committee also tries to build consensus on what should be in the bill per se. Thanks.
Deputy Minister, we are not challenging the rights of the courts to review, but review is not a compliance matter. You can only review a thing if you have knowledge about it. And that's why we're saying people cannot become judges and want to preside over African law when they know nothing about African law, they know nothing about African languages. So it means we really have to turn around even the educational system, and that's why we are going to request to make sure that the university committee that is dealing with the question of language on the curriculum, they must appear before us, because they cannot work on an issue for 20 years if they are serious. They are being paid every month, but it takes them 22 years to produce a simple report that is required by Parliament. But also, consensus, Deputy Minister, is important. Civil society is important. But you don't take people who were born in Soweto in 1940, who have never been to Skukuneland or to Inkandla, and then you say they must be the ones who tell us how the customary law of Skukune and Nongoma should look like. So we must really be careful when we say civil society. Who do we mean by this civil society? And the history of this legislation shows that actually the affected communities were not adequately consulted. The people who were consulted were these civil societies who come from the city centers.
No, indeed, I'm still learning, Chairperson. But I couldn't help but observe the many very good observations that have been made. But some of them certainly require some engagement with. The first being, of course, that as the Deputy Minister pointed out, and I thought he would reemphasize when he had the opportunity to respond, which is that this bill is not an attempt at codifying customary law. So if you're looking for the substance of customary law, you're looking at the wrong bill. This bill seeks to regulate how traditional courts must operate. It accepts the fact that there are different systems in various communities, but to the extent possible, it attempts to provide a common set of rules that must apply across the board in a manner that ensures that there is proper observance of the values of the Constitution. So if we're looking for substantive matters of customary law, that would be elsewhere, not in this bill. Right. So perhaps this brings us to a second point, that as I understand it, there is provision for appeals within the systems of customary institutions. The only time you then approach the High Court is on the basis of a review. Now, a review does not deal with the substantive merits. It deals with procedural matters. And these are procedural matters governed in terms of this bill. You don't need to live in a traditional community to understand or to be able to make a determination whether or not the proceedings were conducted properly in accordance with procedure that is fair, which is what a review is concerned with, as opposed to an appeal, which will then look at the substantive issues that have been canvassed before the court to determine whether or not there is rational connection between the decision arrived at and the merits that have been placed before the court. I thought I should perhaps just emphasize that. Perhaps the first point I've made deals with the issue whether or not we're saying African indigenous law is then required to take the back seat and allow Roman Dutch law and English law to continue as they were. Let me say that not even Roman Dutch law has continued the way it has always been since the advent of this constitution. Roman Dutch law, English law, or any other law, including customary law, would be invalid to the extent that it is inconsistent with the constitution. What this bill seeks to do is to assert the values of the Constitution, regardless of whether you're customary law, or you are Roman Dutch or English law, or American law, for that matter. So if we proceed from that premise, I think we would appreciate the import of this bill and the role we have as citizens today, and more importantly, the role that Parliament would need to take into account in the course of processing this bill. I hope that we are not trying to go back to where we were in terms of African customary law in the hope of reasserting what was undone by colonialism. What we should aim to do, in fact, is to bring back everything else, but only to the extent that we are able to align those practices with the Constitution as we have it. The Constitution is supreme law, and even what we may love with the past, with what we come from, with what happens in the communities, But insofar as those practices, however much we love them, are not consistent with the Constitution, we must accept the fact that we will have some difficulty. And I think there is an expectation that Parliament will always be on the lookout to make sure that the courts will then administer justice in a manner that accords with the spirit and the letter of the Constitution. I didn't make all my notes, and I don't want to canvass all the points, but perhaps I should allow my colleagues to deal with the other points, if I may, dear. Thanks.
Now from DG, I wanted to just know as to whether you've got an idea of how many courts you're talking about, and in terms of money that should actually be put into this, do you have a picture?
No, I'm sure
already
my colleagues.
From Bulubedu, we have 300 already, estimate of 300. Is this something that's going to be feasible for the country?
Look, on that issue, I mean, again, it's the problem of what is a traditional court, and you would see from the bill that it's pretty wide to accommodate different levels. Department of Traditional Affairs had said that for the traditional courts that they recognize, and I'm not sure amongst the Bolobedu how many they would recognize, there is a clerk of that court. So the idea, as I said, is that it's only the only new positions of the provincial registrars, of which there would be six, seven, or eight that would need to be put in. Just one thing, Chair, I can't unfortunately, I would have to raise it on the Bolobedu issue, that the question of female primogeniture is a big issue in other traditional communities. I'm not sure how you would react, Chair, to the issue of male primogeniture becoming an issue amongst the Bolobedu, where, as I understand, a decision was taken, I think, in the 19th century of no more men. but it just shows the complexity of our society. I just wanted to quickly respond on the reference group. I mean, Chair, we can give the details that there were not formal minutes kept and things like that, but I can assure you that I don't recall anyone from civil society not being from a rural area. So just to defend that point, we did also make use of two academics who'd given assistance at different times, and one of them was Professor Humonga, who is from Botswana. I can't remember. Anyway, she's from one of the neighboring states. She's at UCT, but she's from... So there was an attempt to bring in knowledge of the systems in different countries. Is she from Zambia? Oh, okay. Okay, sorry. So just to highlight those points, Chair, but then I don't know if Ms. Pillay wants to add anything.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say something about the socioeconomic impact assessment. I think a question was raised about it and whether we had actually conducted such a exercise. A while ago, some bills were subjected to what was known as the regulatory impact assessment. That system was not very well implemented, and many bills did not undergo that process. But a new kind of regulation has come about through the Department of Performance Monitoring and Evaluation, where no bill can go past cabinet without a socioeconomic impact assessment being conducted. So our department conducted such an assessment, and that assessment was signed off by the DPME, and it's when the bill served before cabinet. What the question is, what do we do in the socioeconomic impact assessment? And very briefly, and my colleagues may want to add, is that we evaluate the cost and the benefits. We evaluate the risk, we evaluate who would be the main cost bearers of the piece of legislation. It looks at the different options and our thought processes behind it. So it's a very useful document, and the final impact assessment will be made available to the committee, and it will become available on our website as well. I don't know whether my colleagues want to add anything further.
Thank you, Chair. A whole range of issues were raised today. I'm not too sure whether you want us to respond to them. It's about the opting out. Some of them were in the form of observations. Lots of the things that were raised today were in the form of observations. There were issues raised about justices of the peace. I think that's been dealt with to some extent. Maybe what we undertake to do, if it would help this committee, is to come back next time and say, I've got that information in the office, unfortunately I never brought it with me, how justices of the peace can make a useful contribution in the administration of justice and enrich the debate on that. Chair, you said that people in your community do these take on these responsibilities voluntarily. Perhaps there's a linkage between justices of the peace and the functionaries that you are talking about. We could make those linkages, but I'd like to come back with that information that I have at my office in Pretoria, and we can talk more about those. What the powers of these justices of the peace are in terms of the bill at the moment, it is really more of a negotiating. They're there to negotiate settlements and to promote the resolution of the disputes and to ensure the enforcement of orders that have been given by the traditional courts. So, yes, there is a lot of engagement that we can continue with on that. I hear what the Honourable Matapa said, that it's something foreign and it's dicey, but maybe if we could come back and just talk a bit more about the role, the traditional role played by justices of the peace in communities. So that's just on the one issue. I really don't want to talk too much on the point of courts of law and the nature of traditional courts. Our Deputy Minister said that this is something that we need to look at, and there seems to be different views. Let me just say this, and if we could leave it there, Chair, and come back at a later stage, is that the law advisors just, I think they do recognise that they're courts of law, and they've left Clause 6 as saying traditional courts are courts of law subject to subject to customary law and function in terms of the Constitution. So there's no doubt about that. And as our Deputy Minister said in the discussions on the reference group, everybody was at even that they're courts of law subject to and operate in terms of customary law subject to the Constitution. I think what the difficulty is, and if I could just plant this, if you go to Section 174 and 172 of the Constitution, and those are all in Chapter 8 of the Constitution dealing with courts like your magistrates' courts and your high court. There it says, for instance, it requires all courts must function in terms of national legislation, and their rules and procedures must be prescribed in terms of national legislation. 174 says it deals with the appointment of judicial officers, and it says national legislation must be put in place to regulate the appointment of judicial officers. It requires judicial officers to be removed from office in terms of national legislation, in terms of mechanisms that are put in place. That's dealing with removal. It deals with disciplinary matters. Now, I think the difficulty, if what the state law advisors are trying to achieve is that the bill must recognize that there are differences. Traditional courts aren't presided over by judicial officers in the strict sense of the word. If they are going to be courts of law like magistrates' courts and like high courts, then this bill is going to have to deal with the appointment of judicial officers. It's going to have to deal with the removal of judicial officers. It's going to have to deal with rules on procedure, as required by Section 172 of the Constitution. And that's not what the traditional courts bill is about. If that is the case, it's going to be a total different kettle of fish. I just wanted to make those initial remarks. On jurisdiction, Yes, I think mention has been made of the matters that traditional courts are competent to deal with. Those are set out in Schedule 2, I think, of the bill. And as our Deputy Minister said, that perhaps didn't receive as much attention during the consultation process as it ought to have. And there are a few issues that are set out in Schedule 2, which traditional courts are competent to hear. I think maybe we need to discuss more there are a lot more deliberations are necessary on what traditional courts are competent to do. Also on jurisdiction, you won't see in this bill, which the previous bills had, the previous bill referred to traditional communities, and traditional communities referred back to the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act, where traditional communities are defined. Our bill doesn't have that geographical reference to jurisdiction. I think those were some of the highlights of what was said during this during these discussions. Another thing that came up quite consistently is the cost of reviews. Yes, we recognise that. The reviews are to be dealt with in terms of the bill by means of regulations which are to be made. And I would like to suggest that the regulations must be of such a nature, and they must be made with approval of Parliament, that the way reviews happen, cost effectiveness and access will be play a crucial role to ensure that reviews aren't only there in terms of the law, they are there in fact and are affordable. One of the roles of the registrars of these traditional courts is also to assist litigants in taking matters on review. I just mentioned those two aspects in passing. I think if I can leave it there, Chair, thank you.
I think we need to say, Deputy Minister and DG, your team has successfully presented a product and raised the critical issues that we need to engage with. And we must thank you very much for that. But also agree with you, DG, that the purpose of this piece of this bill is not to deal with the substance of indigenous law. But I want to conclude by saying, you see, constitutions, people are not created by constitutions. People create constitutions to deal with their own issues. And before constitutions are made, like it happened in this country in 1993. In the preamble, we referred to a concept of Ubuntu as an overarching value system. And then it disappeared, that term disappeared in the final constitution, but not in the spirit of the constitution. Because the Ndebele will say Ubuntu. The other Nguni people will say Ubuntu. The Sotho groups will say Wutu. The Bavenda, Balobedu will say Wutu. And the Tsonga will say Wunu. And they all come back and say Umuntu, Mutu, Munu. And which means the whole of Southern Africa right into the equator. African people are united by the concept of Ubuntu, which gives expression to our common humanity, regardless of race, color, creed. And that is the concept that should form the basis of our jurisprudence. Old people who have never been to school will tell you what you do as a word. In other words, they have a standard of justice, which is based on our humanity. So we shouldn't hide behind constitutional values, because constitutional values derive from our common humanity, and that is the highest standard when we deal with the substance of the law. But once more, Deputy Minister Ndiji, we must thank you for presenting this bill, because it presents us with an opportunity to deal with the jurisprudence in this country. Because whether you deal with land, African people cannot separate land from their spirituality. So you can't just go and make a law and say municipalities must regulate land administration and disregard the spiritual aspect of law, because then you start then to undermine the very essence of people's being. And lastly also, we can't say because in a particular area there will be 300 courts, we'll reduce them to 10, because it would mean some sections of the people will operate outside the law because they've not been accommodated by the law. But I think we agree that these matters are complex, but we are paid and we are here to deal with complex matters, and we'll do just that. And Advocate Bassett and Mrs. Advocate Pillay, thank you for not giving up, and we will invite you again and engage, and thank you very much for the good work. Mrs. Rosa, thank you very much for the good work that you continue to do, and we have been educated today. Honorable members, I guess this brings us to the end of our business today, and of this session, we have the session with the minister in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. Okay, thank you.